Most weeks on this program, we talk about the ways we obtain and store knowledge. But as we age, our brains sometimes have other ideas.
There are about 6 million people in the U.S. who have Alzheimer's disease and 16 million who are providing unpaid care.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about dementia with the Alzheimer's Association and with a physician who later became a caregiver. We'll also spend an academic minute with the science of learning. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you need to find information about Alzheimer's disease, your first stop should be your family doctor. That's who'll be guiding you through your experience with the disease, either as a patient or a caregiver. Another resource is the Alzheimer's Association. Dr. Keith Fargo is the Director of Scientific Programs and Outreach for the Alzheimer's Association. He recently traveled to a few locations around the country to speak about what's new in research and caregiving options. He says when he speaks to a group, he talks about the progress in the fight against Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's right. So there is a lot happening in Alzheimer's disease these days in the research area. You know, we sometimes can feel a little bit of doom and gloom, you know, because we know Alzheimer's is a very difficult disease, uniquely troubling, uniquely burdensome, and there haven't been a lot of breakthroughs that we've seen in terms of medications for over a decade, really. But in terms of where we are with the research, there are a number of potential medications in phase 3 clinical trials right now, which actually look quite promising. It would be completely different kinds of medications, actually. Medications that might actually slow or stop the disease rather than just helping with symptoms for a period of time, which is what's available today. So we're really on the cusp of some life-changing kinds of breakthroughs in Alzheimer's research. And the other thing I'll talk about are the things that people can do today to reduce their risk. So we know that there are things that you can do to reduce your risk for developing cognitive decline or dementia as you age. A lot of things that have to do with exercise, the kinds of food that you eat, et cetera.
We've always heard things like, you know, do the crossword puzzle every day. It'll keep your mind sharp. Are things like that possible?
They are. So the Alzheimer's Association has a public-facing campaign called 10 Ways to Love Your Brain, which is really based on a review of the scientific literature that we undertook a few years ago. And we wrote a scientific paper on that, but those get read by very few people, of course. So we took the learnings from that and put it into kind of everyday language that people can wrap their heads around and take action on. And the 10 modifiable risk factors, or what we're calling 10 Ways to Love Your Brain, that are supported by the scientific evidence, include things like stopping smoking, controlling blood pressure. That's a really big one. But they also include things such as keeping your mind active, and that could be crossword puzzles. It could be Sudoku. It could be reading books. It could be taking a class at the local community college. The important thing to do is to continue challenging yourself from a mental perspective with your thinking and memory.
Caregivers are so important for Alzheimer's disease patients. And usually it's just a family member, someone with no training. Is there training or literature available for people who are going to become caregivers?
There are resources that are available, and you are absolutely correct. There are about 6 million people in the U.S. today who have Alzheimer's disease dementia. And there are about 16 million people who are providing unpaid care for those individuals. And as you said, it's tends to be family members. We know a lot of people are sandwich generation caregivers, so they're providing care for a parent usually, but also for minor children living at home. This is enormously taxing in terms of a person's time and energy. So the Alzheimer's Association does make a variety of resources available. And I would include anybody who's dealing with caregiving or thinks that they may be dealing with caregiving in the coming years to call the Alzheimer's Association and avail yourselves of those resources.
One of the things coming out now is the 2019 Alzheimer's Disease Facts and Figures Report. What does this report measure?
So it really, it's about 90 pages long, and it has almost 600 references. And so it measures a whole host of different statistics around Alzheimer's disease. At a very top level, it looks at things like prevalence, how common is the disease in our country, mortality and morbidity, which means how many people are dying from Alzheimer's disease, what kind of disability is associated with the disease before that occurs. Caregiving, you know, lots of information in the report about who caregivers are and what the effect of caregiving is, use and cost of care. So, for example, we know that Alzheimer's is one of the costliest diseases to society. It's actually going to cost our country $290 billion this year, billion with a B. About half of that is going to be picked up by Medicare. Goodly portion is also going to be picked up by Medicaid. And then, of course, there are out-of-pocket expenses, private insurance, things like that as well. And we have full breakdowns on, you know, those dollars in the report. We also every year have new research that we either commission or conduct ourselves. And this year we commissioned a survey, actually a pair of surveys, into the use of the annual wellness visit that's a new Medicare benefit to do cognitive testing. A lot of people don't know this, but a cognitive assessment is actually a required component of the Medicare annual wellness visit. So this is a benefit that every senior has as part of being a Medicare beneficiary. But what we found is that both seniors are telling us and the physicians that we surveyed are telling us that this frankly isn't happening as frequently as it should. About half of seniors told us that they have ever had their thinking and memory assessed, and about half of physicians tell us that it's part of their standard practice. And only, unfortunately, about 16% or 1 in 7 seniors tell us that their thinking and memory is assessed on a routine basis. And this is very different from the other things that you see in you know, your checkups. Blood pressure is checked 91% of the time. Cholesterol is checked very regularly. Eyesight is checked very regularly, on and on. But a person's thinking and memory, unfortunately, is not being checked as frequently as it should.
Well, finally, let's talk about the future of research in Alzheimer's disease. There's so much to research between treatments and caregiving and screening and causes. Where do you think the best bang for the buck is going to be looking ahead?
Well, I think we've seen some exciting things and some exciting things moving forward. Probably the thing that is most recent that I would draw people's attention to is a very large study that reported out maybe 7 months ago or so called the Sprint Mind Study. And this is 9,000 people, and it was a clinical trial of blood pressure control. And they found that intensive blood pressure control actually reduced a person's risk for developing something called mild cognitive impairment, which is a precursor in many cases to dementia. It reduced their risk of developing mild cognitive impairment by nearly 20%. So that is something that you can do now. You don't have to wait for any breakthrough medications. If you have high blood pressure, we strongly suggest that you get that treated because you may be doing yourself a huge favor in terms of reducing your risk. In terms of the future, there are a number of medications that are in clinical trials today which do look very promising. The medications that are available on the market right now are what we call symptomatic medications. That means they treat your symptoms for a period of time. It's a little bit like if you have cancer and you have pain from that cancer, pain medication would be a symptomatic medication. But what we don't yet have in Alzheimer's disease are those disease-modifying medications like we do for cancer. Now, if you have cancer, you can take the pain medication, but you can also have a medication that cures the cancer in many cases. Well, that's what we're looking at now in clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease. So we have to be, you know, a little patient. Some of these clinical trials are going to report out later this year and then several more in the coming years. And there is potentially very, very good news on the horizon.
There's nothing more complicated than trying to treat the human brain, is there?
No, it's absolutely true.
Dr. Keith Fargo is the Director of Scientific Programs and Outreach for the Alzheimer's Association. Still to come, looking at the big picture of Alzheimer's disease is one thing, but talking about caring for a loved one with dementia, sometimes not so easy. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In the United States, 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. By the time a person reaches 85, their chances of having dementia approach 50-50. And the truth is, there is no cure. And despite the encouraging words we heard from the Alzheimer's Association, there's none coming soon. Dr. Tia Powell is a physician and a bioethicist. With her book, Dementia Reimagined, Dr. Powell's goal is to move the conversation away from an exclusive focus on cure to a genuine appreciation of care, what we can do for those who have dementia, and how to keep life meaningful and even joyful. She spoke about the book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
As in so many families, dementia is in my family. My mother had dementia, and her mother had dementia. And I found that even as a physician, a medical school professor, when it came to having a family member with dementia, I really didn't know what I needed to do to provide good care. And I just felt like I was thinking about dementia all wrong. So I kind of set out to figure out, well, what is wrong with the way I'm thinking about it? What do I need to change? What do I need to learn? And so that's really what led to the book. For a lot of us, including actually a lot of doctors, when we think about dementia, we think about somebody at the very, very end stage. So somebody maybe who's bedbound, who can't speak, who's incontinent, who can't feed herself. And that's actually true of a very small subset of people with dementia. The vast majority of people with dementia are in the earlier phases. So it might be the person sitting next to you at a family birthday party. It could be the person you see in the grocery store or, you know, heading to a movie theater just in your community and near you. So if we wanted to really think about what it's like to have dementia, what that person or her caregivers might need, we need to kind of change the picture of what we think about when we think about a person with dementia.
One of the things that you make clear in the book is, even as a physician and a bioethicist, this idea of dementia caught you off guard. Your grandmother and then your mother were diagnosed. And not only are you dealing with that, but also this truth that your odds are not great as far as of not getting dementia.
Absolutely. I mean, my odds are not that great. I think it's likely. And unfortunately, that'll be true for a lot of your listeners as well. So as we get older, the single greatest risk factor for dementia is older age. And if you have a family history, that makes it more likely. And, you know, since so many of us now will live to be 85 or more, we didn't used to do that. But now that we do, a lot of us are going to be at risk for dementia. And I absolutely include myself in that number.
The one word that really caught my attention in your subtitle, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End, two words you don't think of, I guess, necessarily are joy and dignity. But let us begin with dignity, because that's the one that really struck me. How do you start that, as you say, from beginning to end, of making that process of the degradation of the mind a dignified process?
It's a really great question. And I'll say, I know from experience when I talk to people about dementia in the same sentence as joy and dignity, a lot of people roll their eyes and go, this woman clearly doesn't know what she's talking about. I ask you to bear with me. I do actually know what dementia is. I'm a medical school professor. I'm a doctor. And it's in my family. I've seen it up close, and I've seen it from, you know, the textbook and the intellectual side, too. So bear with me. What I'm saying is we don't think of it that way, and I think we should, because it's going to affect a lot of us. If we're going to live to an old age, a lot of us are going to live with dementia, and I personally like to figure out how to do that better. So that's my sort of game plan. And what would dignity have to do with that? Well, I think there are a lot of ways in which we treat people who have dementia, who have cognitive impairments related to old age, that really undermine their dignity. So those of you who have people with dementia in your families, I think, will agree with me when I say, just because you have dementia and your thinking isn't as sharp as it used to be, it doesn't mean you don't have opinions. It doesn't mean you don't have preferences and values. And thinking about how we respect the fact that a person with dementia is an adult, that this may somebody be someone who's worked hard for 90 years all their life, should we be treating them like children? Should we be treating them, in some cases, almost like prisoners? So let's think about what dementia and dignity together would look like. Sometimes it's a small thing. There are nursing homes that decide that everybody in there has to wake up at the same time every day, which is, frankly, kind of what we do in prisons. And I'm not sure what crime some of these older people with dementia have committed, but if I make it to my 90s and I've worked all these years and raised a family and paid my taxes, I'm not sure that I'm not allowed to sleep in if I feel like it. Seriously, I mean, who better? You know, you're ache, you're tired, why not? So there are nursing homes that have decided, right, it's not a prison. These people are not under our control. This is where they live. This is their home now because they need some help. But how can we do that in a way that's joyful, that's respectful, that's comfortable? If somebody doesn't feel like getting up, maybe you don't want somebody to simply stay in bed all the time. You know, that's not good for your muscles. It's not good for your energy. But can we be more respectful? Can we grant the dignity of adulthood to people, even when they have dementia, even when they have quite serious cognitive impairments? So that would be a start. You know, can you get on your own schedule? It seems to me you've deserved it if you've gotten to that ripe old age. And are there other things that we can do, too, that respect the dignity of older people with dementia?
And that's a lesson as much for the patient as they go through the process, but also, of course, for the family. Because I think most people would want the best for their loved one, and sometimes maybe that just needs to be explained.
Of course. I think we could do a much better job with education. There are a lot of people who are quite devoted family members, but no one has really bothered to give them a good education of what dementia looks like, what are the ways in which it develops, what are some of the common problems you might expect to see, and how might you, particularly when your loved one still has enough cognitive skill to be able to say, well, I wouldn't like this or I would like that in a particular set of circumstances. I mean, one controversial issue in severe dementia as we get toward the end stage is feeding tubes. So geriatricians and other experts have been battling for years to explain most people with severe dementia have swallowing difficulties. It's more than 90% of people toward the end stage. So what we used to do is say, well, you know, your loved one has difficulty swallowing. You don't want your mom to starve to death, do you? We're going to give her a feeding tube. We're going to punch a hole in her stomach, and we're going to deliver her mushed up food straight to the stomach. And you don't want her to starve, so let's do that. So that's what we used to do for a lot of people 20 or 30 years ago. There is now a wealth of data, an overwhelming amount of data that tells us that a feeding tube for somebody in end-stage dementia does not improve quality of life. It makes quality of life worse, and it doesn't increase quantity of life. It doesn't make you live longer, and it doesn't make you live better. So what the heck, man? Why do we need that? You know, if you put a feeding tube in somebody, you don't really have to move them to the dining room anymore. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to see anybody. Nobody has to sit there and be with them while they eat or help them. And in fact, because a lot of people, they don't know what that tube is doing. It's uncomfortable. They may pull at it. A lot of people get their hands tied down. They get restrained when they have a feeding tube. It's actually a horrible way to spend the last 6 months to a year of your life. I'd much rather, for me, if it comes to me and it's the end of my life, I'd much rather have somebody try and feed me. I won't be able to eat a lot. That's because I have a terminal illness at that point. Nobody with a terminal illness, no matter what it is, cancer, heart disease, nobody eats a huge thumping meal at that stage in a terminal illness. You eat a little bit, I'd like to taste something. That's one of the joys that'll still be there for me. You know, if I can't eat a huge amount, that's kind of okay, because that's what happens when you're at the end stage of a terminal illness. So I think thinking about what medical technology helps us and what really doesn't, what actually makes the death that is coming to that person worse, what makes us have a bad death, because that's some of what we're using medical technology for, and that's not a win. Nobody really wants that. But I think I take this seriously as a physician. I think we've done, in many cases, a pretty crummy idea of explaining to people in earlier phases of dementia so they can get their choices lined up and write them down and tell their family, and explaining to family members of people with really ill relatives, here's some things that you could do. Here's what I think would benefit. But in the big picture, this is where I would go. I would stick with comfort care. I'd think about, what should that last year look like? Do you want to be able to try and keep this person at home? Do you want to try and keep them, you know, out of the hospital, out of the emergency room, which is so miserably uncomfortable, out of the ICU, which is not going to turn their dementia around? So I think we need to do a lot of thinking about, you know, those of us who can do it, let's smart up. Let's think about, you know, how can we get this thing organized a little bit better to give better support to people with dementia and their families?
My wife's grandmother had dementia and was in a facility for several years, a long time at the end of her life. And so I spent a lot of hours and days in that facility. One of the things that struck me in just sort of watching what goes on around you is that the staff of this particular facility anyway, which I would say was excellent, and I had nothing but praise for the care that they gave our family member. But I remember thinking that it just seemed that so much time and so much effort by the staff was toward the loved ones, because they were so distraught of seeing their close relative in this condition, of not being remembered, of not having their name known, of thinking they were somebody else. And so let me ask the bioethicist on this phone call, how do you balance that of giving the care to that individual who's in the bed, who is the one who's being treated, and versus the people who come in and out however many times, we don't want to judge, but and to really, because they seem to want to be more the focus than the person who has the illness.
Joe, I think you've really pulled up something incredibly important here. I think that dementia can be so hard on the people who love the person with dementia. And I think we can do a lot more with education that we have. I think sometimes people take it, you know, they're very hurt when someone doesn't remember them, someone who's so important to them, you know, your mother, your grandmother, your father, your sister. It's just, it's terribly heartbreaking. And we need to acknowledge that there is sorrow, and that's right and proper, that this is the end of the phase when this person knew you. But that person is still there. And what would you want if you were in their shoes and you could no longer recognize the people around you? What would you want from them? Could you benefit from their presence? Maybe after a certain point, maybe not. Maybe you wouldn't want them to bother to visit if you didn't know them. But I found toward the end from my mother, I'm not sure that she could always have picked out my name. So it's not an insult. It's not that this person didn't love you or doesn't love you. But they are entering in a different phase. And if you can think about how you can give them support and what support you might want there, I think it's helpful, and it's part of the healing process. We have to not only think about the loss of that particular relationship, but just think about how frightening it might be to be in a place where suddenly everyone seemed a stranger. So maybe you can be a friendly stranger. Maybe even though it's your mother, and it's hard, maybe you can be the person that still could make her laugh that day. And she may not know it's you, but you'll know that she is herself. If you can get that laugh, if you can play her music that she loved, if you can bake one of her recipes, and it was her favorite, it was her knock-it-out-of-the-park dish, and you can give her a bite of that, I think that approach, which a lot of people, this is not certainly my own, you know, I'm not the only one who's thinking about this, but I think that approach of figuring out what you can still give, how you can still share a moment with that person, could provide a lot of healing to people as they're suffering with the loss of that, you know, real-time, day-to-day, oh, hi, you know, Sally, it's you, I recognize you. You can't have that, but maybe it would be possible to think of what you could have.
Again, the name of Dr. Tia Powell's book is Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Science is still looking for effective ways to both teach and learn. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Whom do students ask for help when learning? Other students. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lauren Scharf, professor of psychology at the United States Air Force Academy, looks at how students can best help their peers learn more effectively.
Would you be surprised to learn that both students and instructor show higher levels of awareness of inefficient learning strategies than of effective learning strategies? Unfortunately, not only is that true, but data also indicate that students are more likely to implement inefficient strategies when trying to learn. How can we help make it more likely that students use more effective learning strategies? We are in the fourth year of a Science of Learning research project that combines the efforts from our Center for Educational Innovation, Student Services, and a group of students who are part of a recently formed Science of Learning team. We know, both from the literature and personal experience, that students are often more likely to listen to other students than instructors when it comes to advice about how to learn material. Our student team gets trained on the science of learning, and then they lead seminars for their peers. These seminars are required for students on academic probation, but all students are encouraged to attend. They are titled, Study Smarter, Not Harder. As part of our ongoing study, we collect data on awareness and implementation of the various learning strategies and investigate how attendance at the seminars impacts those factors. We are showing positive shifts and have received many thank yous from the students who have tried the new learning approaches and found greater success. It's been exciting working on this collaborative project and seeing the students help their peers learn to learn more effectively. There is a wealth of science of learning research that needs to be better implemented, and this is one great example of how that can be done.
That was Lauren Scharf of the United States Air Force Academy. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.